Welcome to Session 3 of the Update on HIV and SARS-CoV-2 Online Symposium, held with safety precautions in the studios of Rularta Healthcare and with remote presentations. We thank ViiV for their support of these programs. This session focused on viral reservoirs of HIV-1 infection. Leading off, Matthias Lichterfeld, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School in Boston, discussed distinct viral reservoirs in individuals with spontaneous control of HIV.
So as you know, the problem that we're dealing with in HIV infection is that of persisting reservoirs, which we are defining as cells that are HIV-infected cells that are persisting in the setting of suppressive treatment. And obviously, these are HIV-infected cells that are very small in numbers. It's about 1 in 1 million CD4 cells. And what HIV does is it's integrating into the host chromosomes, and that's the preferred mechanism for persisting in the infected person's organism for the lifetime of that person. What's very important to distinguish then is the proviruses that are integrated into the human genome that are genome intact, which have the ability to produce productive viral particles. And that's an important distinction because we have recognized that there is a substantial proportion, actually the majority of proviruses that are integrated into the human genome, which have certain types of defects that preclude HIV replication. So that distinction is important when we think about technologies for analyzing the reservoir. And what we have done in the past is developing this FlipSeq assay, which we're using to analyze proviruses that are intact and distinguish them from those that are defective. So what we're doing is we are using patient-derived cells. We are diluting those cells to single HIV genomes, and then we are conducting near full-length nested PCR to amplify almost the complete virus. And then this virus is being submitted for deep sequencing and individually analyzed. For analyzing the sequences that are coming back from the next generation sequencing technology, we are using a sophisticated computational pipeline. It's designed to specifically look at all these different types of sequences and identify certain types of defects, such as large deletions, internal inversions, hypermutations, premature stop codons, and so on and so forth. And usually there's only a very small proportion of all proviruses that don't have any of these defects and are characterized as genome intact. We can move ahead and then look at the chromosomal integration sites of these proviruses. That is a very important component of this type of research because location matters. We believe it's critical at what position proviruses are integrated in the human genome because it heavily influences their transcriptional activities. So here's an example of how this looks like at the end of the day. We are looking at three different patients here. These phylogenetic trees are all reflecting individual intact proviruses. And for each of these proviruses, we have identified the corresponding integration site in the human genome. For certain proviruses, we actually find several components, several members that are completely identical in terms of the proviral sequence and also in terms of the integration site. That's a recognized phenomenon in this type of research. It reflects that the cell that was harboring this particular provirus was actually proliferating and passing on its sequence to daughter cells during cell division. So I'm quickly going to move on now and talk about the allele controllers, which is a very small proportion of all HIV-infected patients who are naturally controlling HIV in the absence of treatment. It's about 0.1% of all patients, and in a way, these patients probably reflect the closest possible approximation to a cure that is naturally possible. And for this reason, we are very interested in studying these patients and learning more what's contributing to this extraordinary disease outcome. So in order to study these patients, we first analyzed the number of intact HIV proviruses using the technologies that I talked about earlier. And we're doing this in a large cohort of elite controllers. We have recruited here 64 of those, and we have a comparison cohort of 41 ART-treated patients. And you can see here the total proportion of intact proviruses in elite controllers is substantially lower compared to ART-treated persons. Within each patient, we find a sort of clusters of identical proviruses that are most likely derived from clonally proliferating CD4 T cells. The reservoir in this particular patient looks almost like it's just a single clone, or in this case, it's actually two different proviral sequences. And one of them is this large clone here is integrated into the centromere of the chromosome 15 here. That's a very unusual location for HIV. And what do we know about these centromeric positions? So it happens to be that the centromeric location of each chromosome is a non-coding region that includes highly repetitive DNA. And it's far away from any genes, so it has no transcriptional activity. That's why it's also called a gene desert. And what's been recognized in the past is that HIV doesn't like to go into these sites. It's a very rare site for integration. And once it's integrated into these locations, it is associated with what we're calling deep latency, which means it's very hard to reactivate HIV from these locations.
Professor Lichterfeld also found another site of HIV integration in elite controllers, a small region of chromosome 19 occupying about 0.3% of the human genome, containing zinc finger or ZNF genes.
And it happens to be a part of the human genome that has very strong heterochromatin features. So it has some repressive chromatin components, particularly in terms of histone modifications that are suppressing transcriptional HIV activity. So we're looking at elite controllers at our ART-treated patients and some of the previous studies, and you can see that in terms of integration sites in non-genic DNA and centromeric DNA and in satellite DNA, we always find that these are selectively and highly significantly enriched in elite controllers. And we also find the same thing for the ZNF sites, the ZNF family in total, the Krebs ZNF genes, and also this Krebs ZNF gene on chromosome 19. All of those are highly enriched in elite controllers. And what all these different integration sites have in common, as I said, is really that they are heterochromatin locations, so locations in which HIV is integrated, but it cannot be easily expressed. It is in this condition that we are referring to as deep latency. And that's probably one of the mechanisms that's contributing to the ability of these patients to maintain undetectable viral loads for prolonged periods of time in the absence of treatment. I briefly wanted to move on and talk about a different group of elite controllers that we are in the process of detecting, and that relates to patients who may be potentially have a sterilizing cure or are approaching a sterilizing cure of HIV. And then there's that second group of elite controllers in which we find actually very high numbers of intact proviruses. They seem to be clonally expanded, and they seem to be located in regions of the human genome that have heterochromatin features and are associated with transcriptional repression. And we believe that this particular reservoir configuration in elite controllers is probably a result of selection forces, likely cellular immune-mediated selection forces that have eliminated infected cells from alternative positions in the human genome that are more permissive to transcription. So then, in a way, that deep latency profile that we are seeing is most likely a consequence of immune activity. But what this work highlights from a high-level perspective is that it is really not about quantity when we are talking about HIV cure or a functional cure. It's more about quality of the reservoir. It's about location of the reservoir. And that we are proposing that this block and lock strategy of viral eradication, so getting rid of all proviruses that can be reactivated and having those proviruses that are block and lock, those can persist long term, that is potentially a model for a cure of HIV.
Moving on, Professor Robert Siliciano of Johns Hopkins University in Maryland in the United States discussed the different assays that exist to measure the HIV-1 latent reservoir, pointing out the need for a pragmatic assay that can be used in clinical trials and in practice. He said the latent reservoir is the major barrier to curing HIV, and his laboratory has designed an intact proviral DNA assay, or IPDA, to probe the reservoir of latent virus. He first laid out the problem of measuring the reservoir of latently infected cells.
In these latently infected cells, the viral genome is not being expressed, and so the cells are essentially indistinguishable from uninfected cells, and therefore difficult to measure. And yet, as we develop interventions towards a cure, we're going to need to be able to accurately measure the reservoir. You've heard about some elegant techniques involving full genome sequencing and integration site analysis, but these are extremely labor-intensive. And what we need is a scalable assay to be used in the clinic. So I'd like to describe some of the basic science behind measuring the reservoir and describe a new scalable assay for the latent reservoir. So the reservoir was initially identified with a quantitative viral outgrowth assay in which latency is reversed with T-cell activation, and then the virus is released and spreads through the culture. This assay requires about 2 to 3 weeks of tissue culture work in a BSL-3 lab, and it's really only done in a couple of laboratories. Most investigators have resorted to a simple PCR assays that detect the proviral DNA. In a study carried out by my wife Janet and Steve Deeks a couple of years ago, these PCR assays were compared to the viral outgrowth assay, and the finding was that PCR-based assays give infected cell frequencies that are much higher than and poorly correlated with the viral outgrowth assay. And then Yachi Ho and our group provided an explanation for this discrepancy by doing a full genome sequencing of individual proviruses. And what she found was that most proviruses are defective with large deletion or hypermutation, so that the standard assays, which just measure a subgenomic region of the virus, are a very poor way to understand the replication-competent viruses that are the source of a viral rebound. But what's really remarkable is just the number of these mutations, the G to A mutations, and in some proviruses, up to 40% of all of the G's in the whole genome are mutated to A. So these proviruses have stop codons in every open reading frame and are completely dead for replication, as are the proviruses with large deletions. So clearly, we don't want to be measuring these. These could never cause a viral rebound. So just to put this in perspective, with standard PCR assays, you detect infected cells at a frequency of, let's say, 1,000 per million, much higher than the frequency you detect with the viral outgrowth assay. And most of this difference is due to the defective proviruses that I've described. But interestingly, one of the most important findings to come out of full genome sequencing is that there's a large number of genetically intact proviruses, about, let's say, 100 per million, that are, most of which are not detected in the viral outgrowth assay. And we need to know whether all of these are capable of causing viral rebound. We've shown that they have functional LTRs that are not methylated. They're integrated in general into expressed genes, and they can replicate when reconstructed. So nothing to indicate that these could not cause viral rebound if they were induced. And to determine whether they could be induced, we've carried out cultures in which we've taken cells from wells negative for viral outgrowth and simply subjected them to additional rounds of T-cell activation. And although all of the cells in these cultures proliferate, some don't produce virus until after a second or third or fourth round of T-cell activation. So what it really looks like is this. Each time you activate, you can induce additional proviruses. And this gave us the idea that perhaps the best way to measure the reservoir is to look at all of the genetically intact proviruses, regardless of their transcriptional state at any particular time. And that was the idea behind what we call the intact proviral DNA assay. And looking at a gene-by-gene level, what you can see is that most defective proviruses are actually defective in most viral genes. And these are due to defects in either the start codon, internal stop codons, or deletions. And for genes that require splicing, You can also have defective splice sites. So, for example, the TAT gene, which is required for high-level gene expression, is defective in 95% of defective proviruses. And so what this means is that cells with defective and intact proviruses may be affected differently by curative interventions because the defective proviruses generally will not be well expressed. And what it really says is that you need to measure these, you need to measure intact proviruses separately. So how can we do that? We can do that with digital PCR, where we distribute DNA from infected cells into nanoliter-sized droplets so that no droplet gets more than a single provirus. And then you can interrogate the provirus with duplex PCR reactions occurring in each droplet. And we found that with just two amplicons, you can do a very good job of distinguishing between intact and deleted proviruses, one amplicon in a packaging signal, which is a frequent site of small deletions, and the other in the envelope gene in a region that also contains a conserved area. So the assay works like this. The DNA is distributed into these droplets and then interrogated with two PCR reactions to distinguish intact from defective proviruses. So proviruses with defects at the 3' end will end up in the upper left quadrant of this dot plot. Proviruses with defects at the 5' end of the genome will end up in the lower right. And then intact proviruses, which give fluorescence for both amplicons, can be directly counted as a double positive events. And the assay also has a separate digital PCR for host gene that allows us to determine a cell number and correct for DNA shearing. There's some analytics, and then the output is the number of intact proviruses per million CD4 cells. There's essentially no background in this assay, so a very precise gating can be used. The only real problem is that there are occasional patients with sequence polymorphism. So we've now applied this to large numbers of patient samples. So these results actually are very consistent with results of our full genome sequencing. And looking in blood and lymph node with this assay, we see very similar frequencies. So we believe that the IPDA is a reasonable replacement for standard PCR assays, which are mainly detecting defective proviruses. The IPDA assay gets us much closer to the number of genetically intact proviruses. The advantages are we are excluding almost all of the defective proviruses. We're detecting intact proviruses that are missed by the quantitative viral outgrowth assay because they're not induced by one round of T-cell activation. We're directly counting proviruses that lack common defects. And this is a scalable and cost-effective way to measure the reservoir. The disadvantages are that some of the proviruses that are double positive have minor defects that we can't detect. And as I mentioned, in some patients, there are polymorphisms that preclude amplification. Also, this assay doesn't tell us about the clonal composition of the reservoirs. And so we have been able to look in a cohort of injection drug users who had been on stable ART for the previous 6 months, but prior to that had variable histories of adherence to ART regimens, with some going on and off with what we call non-structured treatment interruptions really related to drug use, and with also variable patterns of current drug use. And we've been able to assess the size of the reservoir in this patient population. And here are the results. And for people in the study who had different current patterns of drug use. And surprisingly, the frequency of latently infected cells was not much different than in other cohorts with other risk factors and was not affected significantly by current use of heroin, cocaine, or both. What did stand out in this study was that a history of frequent non-structured treatment interruptions was associated with higher reservoir size. So reservoir size not strongly affected by ongoing use of these drugs, but is larger in people with a history of non-structured treatment interruptions. And these results, I think, support the inclusion of people who inject drugs with stable suppression of viremia in CURE studies. Now, I'd also like to describe how this assay has been used to sort of reassess the reservoir dynamics, and this is the half-life measurements carried out originally by my wife Janet many years ago, demonstrating a decay rate of half-life of 44 months using the quantitative viral outgrowth assay. We've now looked, in collaboration with Steve Deeks and Mike Peluso, at the decay rate using the IPDA. And what you can see here is that the decay rate of cells with intact proviruses is actually faster than the decay rate of cells with defective proviruses, which essentially do not decay at all over time. And I think this is a very interesting finding. It says that actually the fate of a cell is affected by whether or not the provirus is intact. And as I mentioned, most defective proviruses are defective in TAD and likely to only give minimal viral gene expression upon latency reversal. So this suggests that the capacity of a cell to express it in express viral genes does allow over time some degree of killing either through immune mechanisms or perhaps viral cytopathic effects, so that there is a difference in the decay rate depending on whether the provirus is intact or not. And this has now been seen in three separate studies using the IPDA. I think the real question now is, what is this difference between the cells with intact proviruses and the cells that we detect in the quantitative viral outgrowth assay, that is, cells that actually produce virus following T-cell activation. And this is the issue of inducibility of cells with an intact provirus. And as I mentioned, by additional rounds of T-cell activation, you can induce additional proviruses, and this raises the question of whether there is some kind of stochastic phenomena that determines inducibility, or whether there are cells that are in a deep state of latency, as was mentioned by Matthias, perhaps related to the site of integration. It's also been suggested that this may be related to T-cell subsets, with different T-cell subsets, for example, central memory cells being harder to induce. So we've looked at this with a multiple stimulation form of the viral outgrowth assay, and we actually do not see major differences between various subsets of memory T cells. And the differences between individuals are actually much greater than the differences between T cell subsets. And in all subsets, even after multiple stimulations, less than 10% of cells with intact proviruses can be induced to produce virus. So here are some other hypotheses to explain this difference. It's possible that there are cryptic defects which prevent replication. It's also possible that there's permanent silencing through epigenetic mechanisms, transcriptional interference, or as Matthias has described, related to the site of integration. But while we sort these things out, I think it's the most important thing is to stop measuring all the cells with defective proviruses, which are clearly irrelevant to the eradication problem. My conclusions are that most of the proviruses persisting in treated patients are defective, and evaluation of CURE strategies requires selective assay selective for intact proviruses. The IPDA is one such assay. The more rapid decay of cells with intact proviruses, evident in long-term studies with a precise assay, suggests that some cells die following latency reversal due to cytopathic effects or immune killing. However, detailed single genome analysis does not provide evidence for CTL selection against cells with intact proviruses, and we clearly need to find a way to accelerate the decay of these cells. The low fraction of intact proviruses that are induced with a single round of T-cell activation, I think, represents a real challenge for eradication studies. After all, T-cell activation was our most effective way of reversing latency, and compared to T-cell activation, most of the latency reversing agents used or tested in clinical trials so far are actually very poor at reversing latency. So we clearly need better ways to do this. And so this inducibility is low in all memory T cell subsets.
Professor Siciliano emphasized that the IPDA should replace the proviral DNA PCR assay. IPDA excludes most defective proviruses and detects intact viruses that are not induced and are therefore missed by the viral outgrowth assay. IPDA allows direct counting of proviruses lacking common defects and is scalable and cost-effective. On the other hand, double positive proviruses with minor defects may not be detectable, polymorphisms require alternative primers, and the clonal composition of the reservoir requires additional analysis. At the end of Professor Siciliano's talk, an audience member asked whether inducibility of T cells in vivo could function differently from that in vitro.
So when we look at inducibility in vitro, we use T-cell activation with mitogens or CD3, CD28, PMAI, Annamycin stimuli that are known to cause sort of global T-cell activation. They may actually be very different than the stimuli present in vivo, which, for example, cause clonal expansion. We know that now the clonal expansions that have been described in previous talks are probably due to the cells responding to antigen. And when T cells respond to antigen, they use an exquisitely sensitive mechanism based on the structure of the T cell receptor, and it requires really a very small number of receptor ligand interactions to trigger a T cell. And so the subsequent signaling events may be very different than the sort of global T-cell activating stimuli we use in the laboratory. And I think this is a problem that really needs to be addressed. It could be that, the nature of T-cell activation and the effects on the provirus in the cell are going to be very different depending on how exactly the cell is stimulated.
And this concludes our summary of Session 3 of the Update on HIV and SARS-CoV-2 Online Symposium. We thank our speakers, Professors Matthias Lichterfeld and Robert Siciliano, for their participation, and we thank you for listening. Please join us again for the final episode from the online symposium. And again, we thank ViiV for their support.